This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatimi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alameen la sharika lah wa bithalika umirtu wa ana غير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful, say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The Sound Stop Story is Iran's foreign minister says Tehran is the only signatory to the 2015 nuclear deal that has fulfilled its commitments, calling on other members to deliver its obligations instead of posturing. Brazil breaks its record for new daily deaths from the novel coronavirus with nearly 2,000 fatalities. A new poll in the U.S. shows about 4 in 10 Americans are still struggling financially a year after the start of the coronavirus pandemic. Welcome to the World News. Iran's Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif says his country is the only party to the 2015 nuclear deal that has implemented the landmark accord. In a tweet, Zarif blasted European members of the deal and the United States for failing to live up to their commitments under the multilateral agreement. He urged them to deliver on their obligations instead of, quote, posturing. The top diplomat vowed that Iran will reciprocate. The U.S. walked out of the deal in 2018 and reinstated tough sanctions on Iran under former President Donald Trump. The new U.S. administration has signaled its readiness to re-enter the agreement, but wants Iran to return to full compliance first. Iran says the U.S. must first lift all of the sanctions. Geopolitical analyst Brian Breletic, that should be, says Iran has every motivation to return to full compliance with the deal if the U.S. lifts sanctions.
As we remember, the deal was upheld by Iran. There was positive signs out of Europe that it would be upheld by the European members of the deal, and even at the time, the U.S. was making promising steps towards upholding it. The administration of Donald Trump unilaterally walked away from the deal. There was no evidence to justify walking away from that deal. And part of President Joe Biden's campaign was to return to the deal. And this is an admission by the U.S. that they made a mistake. The U.S. poses as the global leader, and the Western world tries to pose as, you know, providing leadership for the rest of the world. Well, they made a mistake, and part of good leadership is admitting those mistakes and taking responsibility for those mistakes. there is no doubt that Iran will return to its full commitments under the deal. They have every motivation to do that if the U.S. comes back and if Europe honors and upholds their part of the deal.
The United States has blacklisted two members of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, accusing them of human rights violations. The U.S. State Department imposed sanctions on the IRGC officials and their immediate family members. Washington said the individuals were involved in violating the rights of people detained during street protests in Iran in 2019 and 2020. Tehran has repeatedly rejected such claims by U.S. officials as invalid and hypocritical. The Islamic Republic accuses the U.S. itself of breaching the human rights of Iranians with its sanctions. Iran says Washington's restrictions have adversely affected the well-being of the people of Iran and amounts to economic terrorism. Tunisia says nearly 40 migrants have drowned off its southeastern coast after two boats heading for Europe capsized. The Tunisian Defense Ministry says more than a dozen women and children were among the dead. It says Tunisian Coast Guard have rescued over 160 migrants before temporarily suspending the operation due to bad weather. The ministry says the boats were trying to cross over the Mediterranean to an island in southern Italy. Tunisia's southeastern coastline has turned into a major departure point for those feeling conflict and poverty in Africa and the Middle East. Tunisia says it has intercepted nearly 100 migrant boats since the start of the year. Hundreds of health facilities across Yemen are on the brink of collapse due to the Saudi blockade and lack of fuel. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion has warned that it can no longer store blood stocks. Our correspondent in Sana'a has more.
Thousands of cancer patients in Yemen are in dire need of help. Yemen's National Center for Blood Transfusion and Research says the blood stocks and components of concentrated red cells, fresh frozen plasma, and the platelets cannot be reserved anymore due to the lack of fuel.
We have entered the dangerous stage of the collapse of health centers across the country. Our branches in Hodeidah and LBB have stopped their operations and the rest of the branches are about to stop. There is no justification for this blockade. The interruptions in the import of fuel mean the death of patients with kidney failure and chronic diseases.
The center provides services to hundreds of kidney failure patients and cancer patients, including children with leukemia, who depend on the center to obtain the necessary substances to survive.
This center provides more than 60% of its services to people with chronic diseases such as cancer, kidney failure, and wounded people. The fuel crisis is making an already bad situation worse amid the war and siege. Patients with kidney failure and leukemia need regular checks and doses of medicines, and stopping these services leads to the death of patients.
Yemenis are suffering from fuel shortage due to the continued detention of 14 petrol ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The fuel crisis is threatening the closure of over 1,500 health facilities around the country.
International aid organizations and watchdogs have warned that the lives of millions of people in Yemen are in danger due to the all-out blockade imposed on the country by Saudi Arabia and its allies. The international community has so far failed to take action and stop Riyadh from committing war crimes. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Brazil has once again broken its record for new daily coronavirus deaths with nearly 2,000 fatalities. Brazil's COVID death toll is now above 268,000. It is the world's second worst hit country in terms of fatalities after the U.S. Brazil also has the third largest infection tally in the world with more than 11.1 million cases. Situation is dire there with hospitals being overwhelmed and a vaccination program going slowly. Despite that, President Jair Bolsonaro has renewed his criticism of quarantine measures. Brazil is followed by Mexico in terms of total virus fatalities. Mexico's death toll is nearing 192,000 out of more than 2 million cases. A newly conducted poll in the U.S. shows about 4 in 10 Americans are still grappling with the financial impact of the coronavirus pandemic. A survey conducted by the Associated Press suggests 1 in 4 U.S. citizens have experienced household layoffs during the pandemic. It also shows COVID-19 has affected poorer communities and people of color more adversely. The outbreak has also impacted service, entertainment, and travel sectors worse than the others. The United States is the worst-hit country in the world by the coronavirus. It has recorded more than 29 million infection cases and over 527,000 fatalities. Economics professor David Barkin believes a bill by the new U.S. administration to address the unequal impact of the COVID crisis on American society would hardly prove beneficial.
The figures you talked about in terms of layoffs, the terms of the discrimination against people of color, Latins, other minority groups, only begins to touch the surface of the depths of the inequality of the, I'm sorry, the unequal impact of the virus, the pandemic, on the American people. What's the most extraordinary thing about it is the hope that the way in which the new legislation that Biden has now pushed, I think almost pushed through the Congress, will try to reverse this dynamic. And I'm not sure of that, because the impetus of the new program is to depend upon the market through greater spending. But I think that the real problem is that there are structural issues that are involved.
And now, Britain summons the European Union's UK representative amid a deepening row over COVID-19 vaccine exports. This comes after European Council President Charles Michel claimed Britain and the U.S. have imposed a ban on the export of vaccines produced in their territory. In a letter to Michel, UK Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab argued that any references to a UK export ban or any restrictions on vaccines are completely false. The EU is criticized for a slow vaccine rollout and not doing enough to supply jabs to poor countries. But the bloc defended its overall strategy, saying without Europe, it would not have been possible to develop several vaccines in less than a year. The chances of survival for those suffering severe illness due to COVID-19 differs greatly across the European Union. EU lawmakers say the pandemic has highlighted deadly health inequalities within the bloc. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
How the EU deals with crises was the subject of scathing criticism during a debate on the bloc's health systems in the European Parliament. There were major failings when COVID-19 began to wreak havoc in Italy 13 months ago, and now the EU's vaccine strategy is being described as a fiasco.
Citizens are wondering why we are not rolling out the Chinese, Russian or Cuban vaccines. Perhaps it's because the European Union has decided to give more importance to relations with the US instead of saving thousands of people.
The death toll from COVID-19 in the 27-country EU is approaching 550,000.
The pandemic exposed the vulnerability of our healthcare systems as we experienced care disruptions, medical shortages, health system inadequacy, insufficient and unequal access to healthcare.
Instead of improving during the course of the pandemic, apparently the situation is getting worse.
Some of these inequalities are widening, not only across countries, but also across population groups within each country.
One clear example of inequality was highlighted during the debate. Statistics show a person in intensive care with COVID-19 in Luxembourg has a 65% chance of survival. In fellow EU nation Romania,
It's just 25%.
Some legislators say the EU's poor handling of successive crises has dangerous political consequences, and experts agree.
We're seeing the rise of the far right across Europe, and this is not just far right, not right, just right-wing populism. This is naked racism. This is neo-fascism.
The EU Commissioner for Health, Stella Kariakides, has told lawmakers that lessons have been learned the hard way due to the coronavirus.
Indeed, we're determined to respond in a way that looks to the future and develops concrete benefits and protection to the citizens.
Legislators have just passed a €5.1 billion budget for a programme called EU for Health. However, they are well aware that reforms don't happen overnight when it comes to the EU project. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
New research shows cotton masks that become moist through breath are better at halting the spread of the coronavirus. The research was conducted by the U.S. National Institute of Standards and Technology. It shows humidity from human breath makes cotton masks 35% more effective at capturing particles than when they are dry. When particles pass through a moistured cotton mask, they absorb some of the moisture inside and grow larger. That makes the particles more likely to get trapped in the masks. That is why the study says synthetic fabrics showed no performance change in stuffing particles when humid. Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan says the president has eventually agreed to dismiss Chief of General Staff Oniker Gasparyan. Pashinyan dismissed Gasparyan last month after the army demanded the premier step down. Prime Minister Pashinyan said the call amounted to a coup attempt and sacked the army chief. The president, Armen Sarkisyan, refused to give the final approval to the dismissal, saying it was unconstitutional. The Armenian prime minister has faced calls to resign since he reached a ceasefire deal with Azerbaijan over the Nagorno-Karabakh conflict in November. Under the deal, Azerbaijan took some districts in addition to those it captured during the conflict. Catalonia's pro-independence civil society has protested a vote in the EU Parliament to strip three Catalan MEPs of their impunity from prosecution. The MEPs are wanted in Spain for organizing the 2017 illegal referendum on independence. Kusai Kedri reports from Catalonia.
The EU Parliament vote to strip Catalonia MEPs of their immunity came as no surprise to politicians in Barcelona and Madrid. The vote, cast Monday and held secret until Tuesday morning, was backed by 400 European lawmakers. 248 voted against it and 45 abstained. The decision was welcome news for Spain, which is seeking the extradition of the former president of Catalonia and his aides for sedition and misuse of public funds.
The decision sends out three messages. First, an MEP cannot use their status to avoid appearing before court for possible breaches of national law. Second, this is evidence of the solidity of the rule of law in Spain and the respect for the Spanish justice system. And third, the problems in Catalonia must be resolved within Spain, not in Europe.
Catalonia's pro-independence civil society groups believe the decision is a major setback for European democratic institutions.
They should think more about what they are doing by covering the interests of the Spanish state, because they are undermining the ability of the European Union to let rights.
The European Parliament are air entry to the Eurochamber to EU lawmakers.
With the current course of events with the Spanish government has almost tripled, and this is huge and speaks tons, speaks thousands of on one hand how the Spanish government is handling the situation, on how the European Commission is not handling the situation.
The European vote revealed deep divisions within the coalition government in Madrid after junior partner Podemos decided to vote against lifting the immunity for Puigdemont, Comín and Ponsatí. Puigdemont's lieutenant in Catalonia Monday noted that the strategy of the separatists to take the conflict to the world stage is beginning to bear fruit.
The internationalization of the repression of Catalan elected officials by the Spanish state is more relevant than ever before in the heart of Europe. We will see what precedent this case sets in EU courts and parliament.
As Spain mulls issuing new arrest warrants for the three Catalan MEPs, their defense team have vowed to take the case to the European Justice.
All eyes are now on the European Court of Justice, where the next legal battle will play out, much to the discomfort of EU member states, which seem increasingly embroiled in the Catalan case for independence. Cusay Kedrup, Barcelona.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
Supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day He appointed for a rising. To Thee belongs praise, for Thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst Thou willed, Thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to Thee belongs praise, for Thou created, then proportioned, and ordained and decreed, and gave death and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and and encompass the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure, and provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
Even if U.S. President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut Guantanamo down, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes. Now present you an article written by Ramzi Baroud, a journalist and editor of the Palestine Chronicle. The piece is titled, Is This Who Americans Are? Gitmo is the U.S.'s Enduring Shame. The article was taken from the MintPressNews.com website. Please stay with us for more of Ramzi Baroud's article. Certainly our goal and our intention. This was the non-committal answer given by the White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki when, on 12th of February, she was asked by a reporter whether the new Joe Biden administration intends to shut down the notorious prison at Guantanamo Bay by the end of the president's first term in office. Jen Psaki's answer may have seemed reassuring. The untold suffering experienced by hundreds of men in this American gulag, many of whom were surely innocent, would be finally coming to an end. However, considering the history of Guantanamo and the trail of broken promises by the Barack Obama administration, the new administration's pledge is hardly reassuring or encouraging. Compare the new language with that of Obama's impassioned diatribes about humanity, justice, and American values, which he utilized whenever he spoke of Guantanamo. Barack Obama said at a speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013, Guantanamo has become a symbol around the world for an America that flouts the rule of law. Enamored with his every word, Obama's audience clapped with enthusiasm. When he delivered that particular speech, Obama was then serving his second term in office. He already had ample opportunity to shut down the prison, which operated with no international monitoring and entirely outside the realms of international and U.S. laws. Barack Obama is likely to be remembered for his words, not his actions. Not only did he fail to shut down the prison, which was erected by his predecessor George W. Bush in 2002, but the Guantanamo industry continued to thrive during his term in office. For example, in his speech, Barack Obama made reference to the high cost of $150 million each year to imprison 166 people. According to the New Yorker magazine, reporting in 2016, Guantanamo's budget had morphed to $445 million last year when Barack Obama was still in office. Yet, as the budget grew by leaps and bounds, the number of Guantanamo prisoners dwindled. Currently, there are only 40 prisoners still residing in that massive edifice of metal, concrete, and barbed wire, located at the eastern tip of Cuba, built atop a piece of land leased by the United States back in 1903. It is easy to conclude that the U.S. government keeps the prison open only to avoid international accountability, and arguably to extract information by torture, an act that is inconsistent with American laws. But this cannot be it. On the one hand, the entire wars against Afghanistan and Iraq were illegal under international law. Such a fact hardly stopped the US and its allies from savagely invading, humiliating, and torturing entire populations, with no regard whatsoever to legal and moral arguments. On the other hand, Guantanamo is merely one of many American-run prisons and detention centers throughout the world that operate with no manual of rules and according to the most ruthless tactics. The tragedy of Abu Ghraib, a U.S. military detention center near Baghdad, only became famous when direct evidence of the degrading and incredibly violent conduct that was taking place within its walls was produced and publicized. In fact, many American officials and members of Congress at the time used the Abu Ghraib scandal in 2004 as an opportunity to whitewash and rebrand American crimes elsewhere and to present the misconduct in this Iraqi prison as an isolated incident involving just a few bad apples. The few bad apples argument made by George W. Bush was more or less the same logic utilized by Barack Obama when he championed the closure of Guantanamo. Indeed, both presidents insisted that neither Abu Ghraib nor Guantanamo should be made out to represent what America is really all about. Is this who we Americans are? Barack Obama animatedly and passionately asked as he made a case in favor of the closure of Guantanamo, speaking as if he was a human rights advocate, not a commander-in-chief who had direct authority to shut down the entire facility. The truth is that the Abu Ghraib tortures were not a few bad apples, and Guantanamo is indeed a microcosm of exactly what the United States is or has become. From Bagram prison in Afghanistan to Abu Ghraib in Iraq to Guantanamo Bay in Cuba to the many floating prisons, news of which was leaked by U.S. media in 2014, the U.S. government continues to make a mockery of international and humanitarian laws. Many American officials who genuinely advocate the closure of Guantanamo refuse to acknowledge that the prison is a symbol of this, of their country's intransigence, and refuse to accept that, like any other country in the world, it is accountable to international law. This lack of accountability has exceeded the U.S. government's insistence to act alone, as in to launch wars against international mandates. One U.S. administration after another has also made it clear that Under no circumstances would they allow accused war criminals to be investigated, let alone stand trial before the International Criminal Court, the ICC, at The Hague, Netherlands. The message here is that even America's bad apples can potentially walk free, regardless of the heinous crimes that they have committed. Just months after the Trump administration imposed sanctions on International Criminal Court, ICC, judges to punish them for potential investigations of U.S. crimes in Afghanistan, it freed the convicted criminals who carried out horrific crimes in Iraq. On 22nd of December, Donald Trump pardoned four American mercenaries who belonged to the private military firm Blackwater. These convicted murderers were involved in the killing of 14 Iraqi civilians, including two Iraqi children, in Baghdad in 2007. When President Joe Biden fulfills his promise of shutting down Guantanamo or not, little will change if the U.S. remains committed to its condescending attitude towards international law and to its undeserved view of itself as a country that exists above the universal rights of everyone else. That said, Guantanamo on its own is a crime against humanity, and there can never be any justification to rationalize why hundreds of people are held indefinitely, without trial and without due process, without international observers, and without ever seeing their families and loved ones. The explanation often offered by the pro-Guantanamo pundits is that the prison inmates are dangerous men. If that was the case, indeed, why were these supposed criminals not allowed to see their day in court? According to a report by Amnesty International published in May of 2020, of the 779 men who were taken to that facility, only seven have been convicted. Worse, five of them were convicted as a result of pre-trial agreements under which they pleaded guilty in return for the possibility of release from the base. According to the human rights group, such a trial by military commission did not meet fair trial standards. In other words, Guantanamo is and has always been a fraudulent operation with no real inclination to holding criminals and terrorists accountable and to preventing further crimes. Instead, Guantanamo is an industry, and a lucrative industry at that. In many ways, it is similar to the American prison military complex, ironically dubbed the criminal justice system. Referring to the unjust justice system, Human Rights Watch derided the U.S. for having the largest reported prison population in the world. Human Rights Watch stated on its website, "The U.S. criminal justice system, from policing and prosecution through to punishment, is plagued with injustices like racial disparities, excessively harsh sentencing, and drug and immigration policies that improperly emphasize criminalization. The above two can be considered an answer to Barack Obama's rhetorical question, 'Is this who Americans are?' Yes, Mr. Obama. In fact, this is precisely who you are." While offering the world's most miserable detention conditions to hundreds of potentially innocent men, Guantanamo also offers career opportunities, high military perks and honors, and a seemingly endless budget for a small army to guard only a few shackled, gaunt-looking men in a faraway land. So even if President Joe Biden is able to overcome pressure from the military, from the CIA, and from Congress to shut down Guantanamo Bay, justice will still be absent, not only because of the numerous lives that are forever shattered, but because America still refuses to learn from its past mistakes.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
onto our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
European News Bulletin.
Good to have you with us. My name is Amina Taylor, broadcasting from the British capital, London. Now we kick off with a developing story after the European Parliament voted to lift the immunity of the former president of Spain's Catalonia region, Carles Puigdemont, and two of his pro-independence associates. Puigdemont and his colleagues became members of the European Parliament in 2019. This after they fled Spain following their failed pro-independence Catalan referendum bid, which was deemed illegal by Spanish authorities. Following the EU's announcements, Puigdemont's pro-Catalan party stated that they will not give up the fight for independence. The three individuals now face being extradited to Spain, which has issued European arrest warrants for the trio. Chris Bambury is with me, the political commentator and author of the book Catalonia Reborn, How Catalonia Took on the Corrupt Spanish State and the Legacy of Franco. You've been watching this for some time. Are you surprised that the EU did this?
No, I'm not surprised. The Spanish are desperate to get Puigdemont and the other two back to put them in jail, as with the other Catalan leaders who were sentenced to Oriol Junqueras, for instance, to 13 years for organising this referendum. I think the result was not going to be in any surprise. The three major blocs in the European Parliament, the centre-right blocs and the socialist centre-left blocs, had all agreed they were going to vote for this. But actually, the result was much closer than would be expected. 58% voted for lifting the immunity, and you can do the rest of the arithmetic. A substantial minority voted against. And this was the first time that the Catalan issue has really erupted into the European Parliament and European institutions. Since that October referendum, which was suppressed by the Spanish using paramilitary police, the EU has stayed quiet on the question of Catalonia and what's happening there, because essentially it supports Spain. Now we have a debate in Europe about what is going on, not just in Catalonia, but inside Spain. And we should remember as well that this vote comes off the back of the imprisonment of a rapper, a Catalan rapper, for the crime of insulting the royal family and the Spanish security forces. That caused a debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. This is causing a further debate on the nature of Spanish democracy. Questions are now being asked in Europe, which is not a bad thing.
But how will this impact the independence push by Catalonia? We know that, of course, the pro-independence party won a slim majority in the last election just a few weeks ago.
Well, of course, a majority of Catalans in last month's election voted for pro-independence parties. But that hasn't stopped the Spanish continuing a heavy-handed policy, essentially of low-key repression in Catalonia, persecuting politicians, mayors, social activists, clowns. Someone who wore a red nose next to a cop, Spanish cop, was sentenced. This policy has been going on. But I think what's also interesting about this, the vote last night, the result announced this morning, is that up until recently, the Catalans were looking for the EU to help. Catalonia was traditionally pro-EU. Now people are looking at this and saying, what democracy is here? The initial decision to lift the immunity was taken by a subcommittee of the European Parliament, chaired by a unionist Spanish MP. And there were eight Spanish unionist MPs on that committee, ranging from the socialists through to the far-right box. That doesn't sound right. And although the socialists are now in government in Madrid, keep saying they want dialogue, we keep having legal actions against independent supporters. So increasingly, a number of Catalans can't see there's any hope of finding a legal way out under the Spanish constitution because this has been blocked, but also see the European Union as supporting the Spanish state throughout this.
Now,
but
do you see very briefly,
as I say, this debate has erupted into Europe, and secondly, it's also erupted into Spain. The Spanish government is split with a junior partner in the current coalition, Podemos, opposing, they voted against this, their MEPs voted against this, they opposed the jailing of the Rafa, they opposed the jailing of the Catalan political leaders, and this is beginning to cause a debate in Spain on the very nature of Spanish democracy, which again can only help towards a resolution of the Catalan issue.
All right, we're going to watch this case closely because, after all, as you say, these three individuals face lengthy jail sentences if returned to Spain. Thank you very much, Chris Mambry, as always. Now, the fallout from the bombshell interview involving former British royals, Prince Harry and his wife, the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, continues to dominate the front pages in the United Kingdom. After the initial shock from the couple's accusations of racism and animosity in the royal court, questions are now being asked about what it all means for the royal family that they left behind. Well, Sai Poreza may have some answers.
The worst royal crisis in 85 years, says one headline today. One of the many others in the British press, following that tell-all tale by the British Queen's grandson and his wife. Perhaps the most damning of allegations, the Duke and Duchess of Sussex's claims of racist conversations by a senior royal about the color of their unborn baby's skin.
The royal family, the institution, is a monument to British white supremacy. It is rooted in Britain's shameful legacy of colonialism and empire. And that mentality pervades the institution, it pervades everybody who works for the institution, and it certainly occupies the minds of the royal family itself.
The two-hour-long interview has drawn high-profile vows of support, even from the White House, and howls of protest from some commentators in Britain.
This is a two-hour trash-a-thon of our royal family.
From the UK's political elite, cautious reaction to the former royals' explosive allegations. Labour Party leader Keir Starmer said they had to be taken very seriously, and the Prime Minister refused to be drawn into the controversy.
I've always had the highest admiration for the Queen and the unifying role that she plays in our country.
But now we've got our family.
Watched by an average of 11.1 million people in the UK, the interview bears eerie similarities to another one a quarter century ago of Princess Diana, Princess Harry's mother, who broke her silence about life among the British royals.
This has had an earth-shattering impact. The royal family has not been plunged into a crisis as serious as this since the abdication of Edward VIII in 1936.
Decades later, and as the world digests the incendiary details about the Windsor family, questions are being asked about the British monarchy's continued relevance in the 21st century.
I don't think the family garners anything like the respect it used to have in the hearts and minds of the masses. And I think this young lady, this biracial lady, has opened up Pandora's box and she's raised huge consciousness. Abolish the monarchy was a hashtag that's been trending on Twitter in the UK for the last few days since the interview. You would never have imagined such a thing the day before this interview.
The mantra at Buckingham Palace is usually to say very little. We're yet to see what will come out of the ongoing crisis talks in the building behind me. But whatever the response, there is no escaping the fact that the British royal family won't come out of this crisis unscathed. Saeed Poreza, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Never thought I'd be doing lengthy royal reporting on this channel, but it's a little bit deeper than that, is it not, Ahmed Kabbalah? Because it's not just about the institution, but the other elements that it's thrown up about Britain. Tell me more.
Yeah, it's raised important questions about race relations in the UK, about the idea of a royal family in 21st century Britain, particularly when such a powerful, wealthy family is so concerned about the pigmentation levels of a baby that is three quarters white and has one African-American grandparent. And people are starting to ask, what is the purpose of the royal family? What role do they serve? And how they deploy the tabloid press to target certain members of the family, like Meghan Markle, when she's not singing from the same hymn sheet as the rest of the royals, or before her, Princess Diana, but yet they use those same aspects of the tabloid press to protect Prince Andrew, who's been accused of the most vicious and vile crimes of sexually assaulting a minor. And people are starting to think, what is this about? Particularly when people in the royal family come forward and say that they're feeling suicidal, having problems with their mental health, and yet the institution of the royal family takes those concerns, and instead of thinking about how to help the individual, they think about how this could damage the reputation of the royal family and say to the individual that they cannot get help. And that's the new thing that's come out since yesterday, because the interview was aired for the first time yesterday in the UK. And that's one of the major points that people are talking about, with Meghan Markle talking about trying to come forward about her mental health problems. Let's play that.
Look, I was really ashamed to say it at the time, and ashamed to have to admit it to Harry especially, because I know how much loss he suffered.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew that if I didn't say it, that I would do it. And I just didn't want to be alive anymore.
Difficult stuff there, Ahmed.
It really is. And what's interesting about this is all she tried to do was have some sort of privacy and leave the royal family, and she's received such horrendous abuse. And one of those most culpable for abusing her on a regular basis is a TV British broadcaster by the name of Piers Morgan. But yesterday, he actually got a taste of his own medicine when Dr. Scholler gave him a history lesson about what the royal family actually represents and its colonial links. Let's play that video.
What kind of grandmother will protect her own son, Prince Andrew, from the potential crime of raping a minor, but will do jack all to protect Harry and Meghan? Especially, I have no doubt that she would have heard about the suicidal thoughts and the help and support she needs. And then you sit there hammering on about how the royal institution is so racist. Are you out of your godforsaken mind?
No, you know what? I find what you're saying about the Queen absolutely disgraceful.
We've got some social media reactions. So Jerry says, imagine bringing your wife and kid to America because it's less racist. Stedman says, imagine how racist you've got to be worried about your three quarters white baby's skin tone. And more social media reaction related to Piers Morgan. But before we get to that, we've got a third and final video where Piers Morgan is debating with his colleague, Alex Beresford, and Piers Morgan actually walks off the stage. Now let's play that video.
And I understand that you don't like Meghan Markle. You've made it so clear a number of times on this program, a number of times. And I understand that you've got a personal relationship with Meghan Markle, or had one, and she cut you off. She's entitled to cut you off if she wants to. Has she said anything about you since she cut you off? I don't think she has, but yet you continue to trash her.
Okay, I'm done with this.
No.
Sorry, no. Sorry.
Do you know what? That's pathetic.
You can trash me, mate, but not my
own. No.
See you later.
I'm being...
Sorry, can't do this.
This is absolutely diabolical behaviour. I'm sorry, but Piers spouts off on a regular basis, and we all have to sit there and listen. 6:30 to 7 o'clock yesterday was incredibly hard to watch.
Let me have just a brief reaction there, Ahmed. One of your best.
Okay, so final tweet from Will Black. He says, coward Piers Morgan flouncing from his own program when challenged on his bullying of a pregnant woman is a joy to behold, but really he should be sacked. Public figures should not be paid to abuse people as it helps to create a culture of racism and misogyny. And as John White said, this is bringing a constitutional crisis. It brings into question the very purpose of the monarchy, and who knows how this drama will unfold.
As you said to me off the air, perhaps she's not seen as a revolutionary figure, Ahmed, but just the fact that she had abolished the monarchy trending because of the impact of this interview may well mean she does a revolutionary thing after all. Thank you so much. Glad I stole that one from you. Thank you. All right, we move on to another story now, because Russia has called on the U.S. to put an end to its so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran, in order for the historic 2015 nuclear deal to get back on track. In a message posted on social media, Russian diplomat Mikhail Ulanov said that it was time for Washington to, quote, ensure the normal functioning of the nuclear deal, the most important component of the nuclear non-proliferation regime. His comments come weeks after the Biden administration stated that it was ready to engage in dialogue with Iran about a return to the 2015 accord. This after Tehran stated it would return to full compliance once the U.S. had lifted its unilateral sanctions. Italy has surpassed 100,000 coronavirus deaths a year after it became the first country in the world to impose a national lockdown to halt the spread of the virus. Italy has the second highest number of deaths in Europe, as the U.K. currently leads with close to 125,000 dead. The total number of infections in Italy surpassed 3 million last week after a surge in cases powered by the highly contagious variant that was first identified in Britain towards the end of 2020. Like the rest of the EU, Italy's vaccination campaign has got off to a slow start, hit in part by delivery delays from drug manufacturers. Now, China has urged the UK's media regulator to revoke the decision to fine CGTN, China's English language satellite news channel. British regulator Ofcom announced on Monday that it would be fining the channel £225,000 for breaching rules on fairness, privacy and due impartiality. This just weeks after it stripped the network of its right to air in the UK. In a tit-for-tat move, China stated that it firmly opposes the fine, whilst adding that the British regulator should do more to punish British media for untrue reporting on China and Hong Kong. Richard Sudan, what links a terror organization, in the view of many, with a key man from Donald Trump's old administration?
That's a million-dollar question, Amina. A pretty astounding headline, really. Oath Keeper seen with Roger Stone, a Trump advisor, is arrested, reports say. Now, of course, the Oath Keepers are a white supremacist armed militia. Some call them a terror group. Now, Roger Stone is a longtime advisor for Donald Trump. And one of the Oath Keepers, Roberto Minuto, was actually pictured with Roger Stone on the morning of January the 6th, which was, of course, the day of the riots in D.C. This photo is of Washington, D.C. That's Roberto Minuto on the left and Roger Stone in the center there. Now, Roberto Minuto has actually been arrested in connection, people are saying, with the riots themselves, which raises some serious questions, as you mentioned in your introduction, about the proximity, really, of Trump's kind of inner circle with those implicated potentially in the DC riots. Now, I think at the moment there's about six Oath Keepers who have been arrested in connection with the riots themselves. And now we're sort of hearing this, and the Oath Keeper in question was actually providing security for Mr. Stone on the day itself. Now, Roger Stone has denied any prior knowledge of the riots, which basically followed the picture you just saw. But it raises questions not just about Roger Stone, not just about Donald Trump even, but we've seen many examples surface in recent weeks, really, you know, showing potentially very close ties between groups which people are saying are white supremacist, possibly terror groups, and the very kind of inner echelons of government. So a lot of questions are really being raised with this story, Amina.
This after we saw Secret Service agents with other members of other terror groups in the minds of some people. It does. There are some very serious questions. And are those questions being mirrored on social media?
They certainly are. Let's go first to Daryl Davis, who says very pertinently, why would Roger Stone use a terrorist group like the Oath Keepers for security? Seems either really dumb or really complicit. Tariq Nasheed says, I told people 6 years ago here on Twitter that the Oath Keepers were a government-affiliated, deputized white supremacist group. One of the top members who is affiliated with Roger Stone was arrested for his role in the Capitol riots. And we have a reaction from Gary, who says, the insidious cartoon like Roger Stone, whom Trump pardoned, who has been trying to bring fascism to America since 1972. Big question mark there.
Next story for me, Richard.
A very harrowing one. The headline says, wrongful death lawsuit has been filed on behalf of Daniel Prude's kids against the city of Rochester. Daniel Prude was a man who died following what many people are saying extremely...